Okay, I'm glad to be back here. And so I'll talk. What? I was already introduced.
Sorry, I introduced him because you were old.
Should I? Yeah, okay.
He also volunteered you to write the business
model. Okay, so. What I thought I'll do, talk about matrix factorizations. And so this will be mostly about some sort of work that's a year or so old. And then towards the end, there will be a little bit of new results on orientifolds. So matrix factorizations, they describe B-type brains on the at the Landau-Ginzburg point in the Calabi-Yau moduli space. So if this is your Calabi-Yau moduli space, then you have large volume point, you have the discriminant locus somewhere here, and then you have the Landau-Ginzburg point here. And so this is where classical geometry is good. And then this is sort of the non-geometric phase of the Calabi-Yau manifold, and this is where the Landau-Ginzburg description is good. And so one thing to note is that when you do the orientifold projection, so when you want to construct type 1 string models, the orientifold essentially cuts a real slice in this moduli space, and then typically large volume and the Landau-Ginzburg point are disconnected at the discriminant locus. So you disconnect the large volume and Landau-Ginzburg point at the discriminant locus, and you want to, so then it's sort of useful to have, for type 1 model building, for example, to have a good knowledge of D-brains and orientifolds at the Landau-Ginzburg point. So that's one motivation in the context of type 1 model building to study B-type brains at the Landau-Ginzburg point. And right. One can also argue that the generic string vacuum might well be non-geometric in whatever sense. And so it's certainly, the Landau-Ginzburg model certainly some prototypical examples of non-geometric string compactification. So in that sense, it's interesting to study brains in the Landau-Ginzburg models. Now, more concretely and more mathematically, what can you do with matrix factorizations, or what have they been used for? So one thing is some information about space-time superpotential on the brain world volume. And sort of related to that, mirror symmetry for open strings, and maybe also you want to include unoriented, although that hasn't really been used much, but so open strings. And so I think that there was a talk by Wolfgang Lerche here in the program earlier, who talked about applications to these sort of problems. So I will not, although probably most of you were not here when Wolfgang gave his talk, I will not review that very much, not at all. But what I wanted to talk about instead are stability conditions on the category of topological V-brains, which you can study at the Landau-Ginzburg point. And then I will also talk about D-brain charges and the index theorem. So that's sort of that's what I want to review here. And then at the end, this is the new part. And this is about antifolds. I think Kentaro Hori. So this is work with Kentaro Hori. And I think he talked a little bit about it, although the focus of his talk was a little different. But so there will be some new results here. Right. So references for this talk, there are many. So this is a paper from last December. This is ongoing work with Kentaro Hori. And general references for matrix factorizations and their applications. Let me just mention the early ones. So this was proposed by Koncevich, and then there was work by Kapustin and Lee from 2003, I guess, and Brunner Lerche, Herbst, and Scheuner, also from 2003. So they showed that matrix factorizations indeed have something to do with D-brains and Landau-Ginzburg models. And then there is a lot of other work, including by people here, Sudre Ashok, I think, Eleonora, maybe other people. So this is the plan for this talk. And so let me start with the main part. So this is some definitions of what matrix factorizations are. And how you construct various constructions with them. So W will be a polynomial, some number of variables. So this is the Wolff-Sheed superpotential of the Landau-Ginzburg model. And I will assume that this has an isolated critical point at the origin. Then a matrix factorization of W is it's a Z2 graded free C of X module M with Z2 grading that I will call sigma. So this is the Z2 grading. And an odd endomorphism Q from M to M, which satisfies Q squared equals W times the identity on M. Okay? And so this is called this twisted differential. And now if you split the M in the even and odd parts, then you can write Q as block off diagonal matrices like this. And then this equation just says that F times G equals G times F is W times the identity on the even or odd component. Okay, so this is, let's say if you choose a basis for this free module M, then F and G are matrices with polynomial entries, and this is the statement that W is factorized as the product of two matrices. And then given two such matrix factorizations, M sigma Q and M prime sigma prime Q prime, the space of Holmes as free C of X modules. As free C of X modules, this has a graded differential. D, which acts like a supercommutator, so D phi is Q prime phi minus 1 to the phi, which using the V2 gradings I can write like this. So this is for phi in this space, and this differential, well, it squares to 0 by the super-Jacobi identity, and then you can take the cohomology of this. And then you get a category of matrix factorizations of W, which has objects, these V2 graded modules with its twisted differentials, and morphisms, cohomology of D. And so this is then a Z2 graded triangulated category. So this is these are results by Buchweitz from the 80s, unpublished. Koncevich, pointed physicists that this might be true, and it was also proved by Olaf more recently. Okay. So physical interpretation, what does this have to do with Diebrins and other Ginzburg models? So you have a lambda Ginzburg model with an F-term interaction integral d to theta w, and then matrix factorization is essentially a space-time, a configuration of space-time filling DD bar system with tachyon configuration given by F and G. And so, in other words, from the Walshi point of view, there is a boundary interaction that you can write down with this such a matrix factorization, and then this induces a Walshi RG flow from this free boundary condition to some interacting boundary condition. Space-time is flat space. So this is the target space. This target space of the lambda Ginzburg model, so it is flat C to the R. Okay. You can do such things also on curved spaces. Non-compact Calabi-Yau manifolds. No, I have it. No, I think this one is only the one where you have to divide out by the trivial factorization. It's implicit in this construction. I don't want to. I want to go through the whole thing. I want to focus on some other constructions. Okay. One first thing is the grading. So so W is homogeneous if there is a grading for these variables X. such that W of e to the I lambda qi xi is e to the 2i lambda W of xi. So there is an assignment of R charges qi qi so that W has R charge 2. Okay? And also let me, h will be the smallest integer such that hqi is an even integer for all I. So this U1 action closes for lambda equal to pi times h. And so now, so this is for the bulk. And now for the matrix factorization, so here you have a U1 action on these, on the target space, so that W is equivariant with respect to this U1 action. So the generalization to the matrix factorization is that you want a U1 representation of U1 on in this group of matrix of invertible matrices with polynomial entries, so that Q is equivariant with respect to this action. So what this means is essentially rho of lambda xi q of e to the I lambda qi xi rho inverse of lambda xi equals e to the I lambda q of xi. So since q, yeah, rho of lambda, so plus even. So I want an even representation. Well, it's a matrix with polynomial entries. Okay. What did I write there? The point is that the group law is a little bit funny, because if you work out what the group law is supposed to be, then you have to act also on the variables xi. Okay, so this is my definition of this grading, and now in all examples that I know of, you can diagonalize this representation. It's not clear to me that you can always diagonalize this U1 representation. Maybe someone here knows. In other words, if there is a gauge transformation, so that you can so that rho is independent of the xi's. But I should also say that doesn't seem possible to work to restrict the gauge transformation to ones which respect the grading. So you have to allow such things. But let me note one thing. So there is a topological obstruction to gradability. So if you look at this this equation infinitesimally, so you define R of lambda xi is the vector field which generates this U1 action. Rho of lambda I lambda xi inverse at lambda equals 0. You get the equation EQ plus RQ equal to Q, where E is the Euler vector field. Which measures this charge. And so if you note that E W is 2W and that W is equal to Q squared, then you learn that Q anti-commutator with EQ minus Q is equal to 0. And then this equation says, so in other words, EQ minus Q is closed. And then this equation says that EQ minus Q is exact. So there is a topological obstruction to gradability. And I want to, well, one way I want to interpret this is that this is mirror to the condition that the Maslov class of Lagrangian should be zero. So this is mirror to the Maslov class. Okay, in any case, if you, so once you have this matrix R, you get essentially a Q grading on the on MF on you get the Q graded category, okay, where the Q grading is defined by on the morphism is defined by this equation. So this is the homogeneous. So if phi is homogeneous, Q I from. So you can decompose the morphism spaces into homogeneous components with respect to this U1 action, and then the equation doesn't make sense. So phi is a matrix. So this.
Oh, actually, that's just multiplying phi.
Yeah.
Okay. You're saying, so it should be obvious that the right-hand side is proportional to phi.
No. So this is so phi is a homogeneous. Now phi is a homogeneous morphism, which has homogeneous Q grade. So you take the space of morphisms and then decompose this into.
The right hand side is a matrix.
The left hand side is also a matrix. It's a scalar times a matrix, so it's a matrix. I'm assuming that. Into the homogeneous. Right. Not quite.
The one with the right hand side is an operator of the conventional morphism.
Okay.
It seems non trivial to me that that matrix could be proportional to phi to a scalar.
Well, not for any phi.
Exactly. So now, but I would have thought that all the morphisms should have a grading. But that means that you can diagonalize that operator on the right hand side.
You think that is a non-trivial condition? As I said, I don't even know if you can if you can recognize these U1 actions. But if I can't prove it, then let me assume it, okay? Okay, this matrix.
Do you have examples so that we know you're not talking about?
Sorry?
Do you have examples?
Yeah. I won't give any examples in this talk, but. That's one of the gratings of Kovanov-Rosansky. Well, if that's that's one example, but anyway, I mean this condition is also non-trivial. So there are examples where of factorizations which cannot be graded. Right, so there are also ambiguities of this matrix R. So of course this equation only defines it up to a Q exact piece. And also I can't prove this, but in all examples that I know, you can fix these ambiguities in a way which makes sense by imposing the condition by the condition that trace of RV is equal to zero for all for everything which commutes with Q. So in particular, the trace of R, so the trace of R should be zero. So if you view this as a gauge infinitesimal gauge transformations acting on Q, then this is the condition that trace of that the character of the group of gauge transformation pi R of V, which is given by trace RV, should be zero for all the trivially acting gauge transformations. And again, I can't prove that this always that this fixes all the ambiguities of R, but in all the examples I know, I can fix the ambiguities this way. You don't believe it, Greg, right? Okay, now the next thing is the orbifolding. Well, I think you can define the orbifold. You can probably define the orbifold because that's degrading by U1 R charge. And when you orbifold, you want to restrict, one condition is you want to restrict to even, to integer R charges. So this will come out of this orbifolding procedure. And also the grading is very important for the stability conditions. So the orbifolding. So let me just say this in words that the correspondence between Calabi-Yau and Landau-Ginzburg models is between Calabi-Yau complete intersections in torque varieties and Landau-Ginzburg orbifold theory. So we have to orbifold, and in these examples here, I'm just going to consider cyclic orbifold groups. So So this would be for Calabi-Yau hypersurface. In some weighted projective space. And then, let's see. So for the ball chiral ring, you're restricting to invariant, to the invariant part of the chiral ring. So the R charges, which are some, which are written like this. So H was the smallest integer, so that H times QI is an even integer. The WIs are integer. They're the weights of the weighted projective space. And so in the bulk, you're restricting the chiral ring to the invariant part under the orbifold action of gamma. So my orbifold group is ZH. Now, in the orbifold context, we want to equip such a factorization with a representation of the orbifold group. And what this means is that gamma q of omega ixi, gamma inverse equal to q of xi, where omega I are the actions on the variables. Yeah, sorry. No, sorry. It's pi I q I over H. Now, for a homogeneous factorization, you can solve this condition by saying that gamma is related to R in this way up to a phase. So this is a phase here. This is a matrix, and this is the Z2 grading. So the condition, it's still, well, it's somewhere here. So the condition on the R matrix was such that Q had degree 1. So when you set lambda equals to pi, you get a minus sign. And then you repair this minus sign by taking the Z2 grading. And then for irreducible factorizations, you're just left with a phase. And that's the definition of That just leaves the ambiguity of a phase, and then the ambiguity of the phase you fix by requiring that gamma to the H is equal to 1. Okay, so then this fixes phi in as a real number mod 2 over H, and then you choose a lift of this to phi in the reals modulo the even integers. And that gives you, for each factorization, for each homogeneous factorization, gives you H equivariant factorizations. And that these are the fractional brains in this Lambda-Ginzburg model. So since all these brains are space-filling, they're all invariant the space-time. And from the space-time perspective, they're all invariant. And so all you have, all you're choosing is a representation of the orbifold group in this Chan-Peyton space. And on the morphisms, so this gives me H fractional brains for every homogeneous factorization. And then on the morphism spaces, if you impose that gamma prime phi of omega I xi gamma inverse equal to phi, and then you recall the definition of the R charge and this condition here, you find that Q of phi is related to these phases, like this up to an integer, where minus, where n has the same parity as phi. So this phi is a morphism from Q to Q prime. Okay. And then now, so there is this Landa Ginzburg, the Calabi-Yau Landa Ginzburg correspondence. So you would want to conjecture that these categories of matrix factorization are equivalent to these derived categories of coherent sheaves. And then there is one last thing that one has to do. You have to lift phi to R. So now, in addition, so you're not just choosing a lift to R mod 2Z, but actually to R. And then you get some category which, let me just denote it like this, with curly M's and curly F's. And then this category is supposed to be equivalent to the derived category of X. So X is the Calabi-Yau, which via Calabi-Yau and the Ginzburg correspondence is related to W mod gamma. Okay, and this is conjectured to be true for all the examples of Calabi-Yau and the Ginzburg correspondences, and it was proven by Orlov actually earlier this year for the special case. So this is a mathematical proof, not a physics proof. So it's not exactly clear how the correspondence works, but in the case that all the weights are 1. Okay, so that, but I mean, in the general case, it's still open. Although, maybe one can, maybe it's not too hard to extend it. Okay, so that concludes the definitions and so on. So now I want to talk about these more special topics. I probably won't be able to do all of that. But so are there any questions about this part? I don't want to say how Orlov writes the functor. I would love to understand how Orlov writes the functor, but I mean, in principle, from the physics perspective, you should be using the linear sigma model to understand how to map these factorizations to a complex of coherent sheaves, but this hasn't, as far as I know, hasn't been done yet. So
what if I take a skyscraper sheaf on a B0 branding, so then there's some matrix factorization?
But
is it done? I take the
D0. Well, one thing is that the D0 brain is, there are these monodromies in the moduli space.
Yeah.
So you can't necessarily.
So that depends on where you are, K1.
Well, this is in, there are odd equivalences of these categories, and so there are many functors. You can always compose it with an odd equivalent. which you're supposed to.
You're going to come to, you really have to choose a path from Lodge Wellington to Land Agency.
That sounds better. Okay.
I mean, in okay, let's say in the case of the Quintic, there are the factorizations, so these are actually the factorizations which were worked out by Diaconescu and Eleonora and Suje. So that's known for the Quintic, and then also other examples. So. No, for the D0 ring. So it's known in special cases like the Quintic, is known which factorization corresponds to the skyscraper sheaf. And I mean, one thing they didn't study is the question whether this D0 ring would be stable at the largest point. So the stability condition allows you to address this question, and it seems that the zero brain is stable, I mean, according to the stability condition. And then there was more work this year which constructed conformal field theory brains in the Quintic EPNE model, which corresponds to this factorization, to the factorization corresponding to the zero brain. So it's likely that the zero brain, if that's what you're asking, that the zero brain at the Land Ginsburg point is in the spectrum.
I have another question. Supposing I think of objects in V of X as bound states of V0, V2, V4, and V6 primes. Okay. And then I'm thinking of space-time as R4 times equal on the L.
Mm-hmm.
Are these sort of single, these are particles which are located at a single point in R4?
Yes. Okay. This is a wall sheet. This is completely wall sheet description. I'm not sure I understand the question.
Those are sometimes more accurate descriptions of bound states of V0 and V2.
Right, but this is a wall sheet description. So, whatever you do in the space-time, you're free to do whatever.
If you have states, I don't care how you describe it. But I mean, if you describe the space.
Okay, then the answer is yes. The answer is yes. I mean, this is supposed to be completely equivalent. So, these multi-centered black hole solutions are correspond to, from the wall sheet perspective, to one of these boundary conditions.
This is topologically twisted, Craig. I mean, can you actually see the
problems? These are supersymmetric factors. These are supersymmetric BPS things.
They're configuration of brains and anti-brains.
No, they're, but.
Well, the stable, okay, you have to impose the condition that they should be stable. Okay, the BPS, so these are the topological. These, if you look at all the factorizations, that gives you the topological brains. Okay, if you want to ask for the BPS brain, then you have to look at the stable one.
Which is some kind of subcategory.
Right.
Wait, what did the question
word? I'm not sure. Greg asked for these.
I'm trying to understand the relationship of this to BPS states with a given set of charges for 0, 2, 4, and 6 rank charge.
Right. So the answer is you look at, you construct objects which have these charges in this category, and then you ask the question whether these are stable. And the stable objects, they will correspond to the BPS state. Okay. See that? Okay, we can discuss this later. But now I have to make some choices. Okay, so there are these three things. Maybe I have time for one or two of them. So it depends a little bit which one, which would be the favorite subject. Okay.
You talk about civility in English.
Well, okay, so it,
perhaps if it's not,
well, it doesn't
necessary prerequisite, the others is
I mean, the point is that the stability condition here is particular to Landau-Ginzburg point, so it assumes the background explained by Bridgeland, I suppose. Okay. Okay, I sort of like your antifold.
Okay, let's hear it.
You want your antifold?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so our antifold, so from the Wolfschied perspective, what this means is that you're dividing out some parity. You want to mod out parity so omega is Wolfschied parity reversal. And tau is an action on target space fields. Okay. So this is in string theory what we mean by antifolding. In field theory, we're from the Wolfschied perspective, we are considering Wolfschied's we are considering the Wolfschied theory unoriented Riemann surfaces. Such as the cross cap or the Möbius strip and so on. The Klein bubble. So let me note one thing. So which confused me for some time, but actually is sort of simple to understand. So in topological field theory, which is what I'm doing here, you can't actually mod out by the parity. Because although it's some sort of symmetry of the Wolfschied action, it's not going to be a symmetry of the correlators. Essentially because if you consider Wolfschieds with boundaries, then you have an ordering on the boundary, a cyclic ordering. And parity will exchange, will invert that ordering. So it will map like this. And so you don't have a symmetry of the correlation functions, and therefore you can't mod out. In other words, you can't even project the algebra of open string fields to the invariant sector. So these correlation functions might be non-zero if you have, let's say, one odd field and two even fields, or three odd fields might still be non-zero. Okay. In string theory, this is resolved because we sum over all the possible orderings on the boundary. But in the topological field theory, we're not doing this. So you can't protect this to the invariant field. So the best we can do is define the action, so define the parity action on all the brains. Okay, on the open plus closed topological field theory.
Maybe
Yeah, but I don't think, okay. I mean, maybe there's a way to define it which solves this problem. I don't know how to solve the problem that the ordering on the boundary operators is.
Because you would like to, you wanted to characterize open.
Oh, you're saying it. Okay, I would be very interested to hear this because I wasn't able to make any sense of. I mean, as I said, there are, you know, there are correlation functions which are non-zero where this is an odd state and there are two even states or three odd states. That makes sense?
Well, you're completely right that you can arrive.
Okay, then. Well, you sum over, I mean, the gauge group actually only comes when you sum over the ordering. I mean, I don't think that's what Albert is saying. Albert seems to have something in mind, which I don't see exactly how you bring. I mean, I can, you don't want to throw away the open string sector completely. No, okay.
It's a computer, it's a computer-based.
Okay, I would be very interested. Let me just define the actions. So for the factorizations, the natural parity-like symmetry that you can imagine is that you take so you have a matrix which squares to the identity times some polynomial, and then the transpose matrix will also do that. Okay, so P of Q is essentially Q transpose. And then you will think that if Q squared is equal to W, then Q transpose squared is also equal to W. But actually, because this is Z2 graded, there isn't a minus sign. So because the thing is Z2 graded and Q is odd, okay, there's an extra minus sign in transpose, and so this is equal to minus W. Okay, so. So in other words, you have to act. This means you need a non-trivial tau, such that tau, so W of tau x is equal to minus W of x. But this is actually fine, because if you think about what this W does in the Wall Street theory, it's an F-term interaction like this, and so parity exchanges left and right movers, so it's going to exchange theta plus and theta minus. So under the parity, it's only going to be invariant if W picks a minus sign under x, under tau. Okay. All right, so this is how you define the parity. And of course, there are many other, you can dress by some other symmetries if you want to. You can go under which W would then be invariant, but you need one at least which inverts the sign of W. Now, then you also get an induced action on the morphism spaces. Q to Q prime to P Q prime P F Q. So this is go to different space, but if you want to, so then you can restrict yourself to invariant objects and study the action of P on these morphism spaces. And then, so let's look at invariant objects. Let's construct invariant objects. So if you take some object Q and you act with parity on it, then either it is equivalent to Q or it's not. Okay. So let's say, let's first start with it being invariant. So this means that there is some gauge transformation, some gauge equivalence between P of Q and Q. Let me try to make it a little bit more precise. So this means that Q transpose of tau x is equal to Q up to gauge transformation. So there is some invertible matrix U. So that Q transpose is equal of tau x is U inverse Q of x U. And U is a map from the dual of M to M, where M was the C2 graded free module. And then because you plug this back in twice, and then you get this familiar equation that U minus transpose is epsilon, so where epsilon is plus or minus 1. Okay. And this is the sign that will distinguish whether you have an orthogonal or symplectic H group on the brain. So it's slightly tricky here because you have sort of two Chen Peyton spaces. Okay, so if the sign, so you make an overall choice of sign for the parity, and then if you have an object which satisfies this, then you're happy. If not, then you have to tensor with some other Chen Peyton space which compensates for this. Okay, let me actually not go over this because this is a little bit annoying. But what's sort of nice here is that you can see very elementarily whether you get an SO or an SP gauge group. Okay, so you don't have to pretend that you understand Douglas and Moore or Timon Polshinsky. You can just read it off from the factorization. Okay, then you can extend this to orbifolds. And so the orientifold group is generally some extension of the orbifold group, where this is, this is the parity. In other words, P doesn't have to square to 1. Okay, actually, I forgot to say this over here, but all these, so for example, this tau here has to square to 1. Okay, otherwise, it's not very useful. And so there are potentials for which there is no such tau. Okay, so for example, if you take W is x to the n, where n is odd, when n is odd, then it's okay. But when n is even, then you can find an involutive parity which does that. So so the condition then, if you have an orbifold, is that P squared should be in the orbifold group. And this is the B model. No, this is the B model. So this is holomorphic. So in terms of bundles, you're taking the dual bundle. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a B-type parent. So one thing you want to exchange theta plus with theta minus, you don't want. It's the dual module. It's just the dual module. No. So it's all the maps from that module to the ground ring. Yes.
So they have something holomorphic. You have complex configuration, you could have complex configuration in a ring tower. Then you will have holomorphic.
Yeah, maybe that's the point.
I mean, there are two automorphisms of the complex state here. There's E minus E and E dot. And when do we stop? I think only the current time is E dot. Well, exactly.
We haven't studied that yet. I mean the exact map for of the charges. No, we don't. I mean, we haven't studied that. Although we have studied some comparisons of the charges between Landau-Ginzburg and large volume in. Where we constructed the Arendt fold in as a Gapner model, okay. And then it matches. But. Okay. Okay. One result I want. I don't know how much more time I will. So there is this is about the cross cap state. So so in other words, you want to compute the correlation function on the cross cap of some element of the bulk chiral ring. Where C is the cross cap or P2, and so you can compute this in this topological B model using the action in so this is essentially repeating computations. Done by Vafa for the closed string, where you get this is where you get these residue formulas. This is on the sphere, which is these residue type formulas of phi and then d1w up to drw. And then there is the there's a formula by Kapustin and Lee for the open string, which essentially says that the boundary state associated to a factorization Q is the supertrace, is one of our factorial supertrace of DQ, which are, okay. And then if you want, you can insert open string operators here, if you want. Okay, so for example, if you have, you can also have boundary condition changing operators, so this would be phi prime, and here you have Q, and here you have Q prime. And so then you have to compose this in the right order. So that would be phi prime here. Okay, so you take the supertrace over M and get this boundary state. And so the result of this computation of the cross-gap diagram is that you get an unoriented, you get a formula for the cross-gap state. I mean, maybe I shouldn't call this string, but so for the topological field theory, you get the cross-gap state. And so what is that cross-gap state? So if you take this this tau, so W of tau x is minus W of x, you get the factorization from this. So if you, let's say, if you diagonalize tau, for example, I mean, this implies a factorization x minus tau x, xi minus tau xi, ri of x. And that you can factorize w in this way, or if you, okay, so anyway, you get a factorization of w just from the condition that this is anti-invariant under this tau. And then the statement is that, so this gives you a particular factorization Q. Actually, let me do this a little more explicitly. So I want to write this as xi, the minus eigenspace of tau I of xi perpendicular and xi parallel. And then the factorization that you have is xi parallel pi I plus ri. Pi I tilde, where these are these matrices generate a Clifford algebra, and so then Q squared will be equal to this, which is equal to W. Okay, so the statement is that this cross-gap state, and now let me call this Q tau maybe. The cross-gap state C is just the boundary state associated with this factorization. Okay. This is. Okay, and then, well, you can extend this also to, you can extend this also to orbifolds and get formulas for the cross-gap, for the charge of the cross-gap state in an orbifold. But I rely sort of on things which I would have said in here, so maybe let me not talk about this. And so it gives you, well, one thing this cross-gap state is good for, it gives you index formulas. And so there are index formulas already for unorbifolded Landau-Ginzburg models. So so for example, just trace minus 1 to the F or minus 1 to the FP over the bulk Hilbert space. So that's the Klein-Bottle correlator. So that's just, so this is the Klein-Bottle. And that's the square of the cross cap on the sphere. And so that would be for the Klein bubble. And then also if you have, so you can compute, for example, trace over H from Q to P of Q. So if you have any factorization, then this space is invariant under P. You compute minus 1 to the F in this sector. And so that's the boundary state. So it's this thing. You just call it B of Q on the sphere. Okay, so you have formulas like this for the indices. Okay, so that essentially concludes what I had to say on the antifold. Yeah, let me just stop here. Thank you.